It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll get our weekly look into what Congress is up to with Paul Singer of USA Today.
First, new reports out this week could shed some light on why the Great Lakes are experiencing very low water levels.
According to our next guest, the lakes, along with other bodies of water, experience natural 10-year cycles of ebbing and flowing, but recent evidence suggests that the cycle might be broken. But why?
Joining us now is Carl Watrous, research scientist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, first, tell us, please, about this 10-year cycle and the research you've been doing looking at that.
Well, technically, it's about a 13-year cycle, but let's not quibble. We began thinking about this in about 2005, 2006, when our local lake levels up here in Vilas County were dropping precipitously. And so we stumbled on a data set that extended back 70 years for these small lakes, and they showed this oscillation. And then we compared that oscillation in our little lakes to Lake Michigan Huron, and they were virtually the same. And then we got a little bolder and decided to look at our groundwater tables as well, and they were fluctuating the same way. So we put together several pieces of a puzzle and were able to detect a signal that's pretty much region-wide.
Why are those all, the groundwater, the small lakes, the Great Lakes, in sync with each other on that cycle?
Well, that's a good question. We think it's because there is a major driver that's affecting everything the same. So even though the lakes and the groundwaters and these huge lakes have different hydrologic budgets, there's one factor that overrides all those detailed differences. And that factor, it turns out, is the difference between precipitation and evaporation. That's called the net atmospheric flux of water. So as that varies in time, we see our lakes rise and fall. And that variability seems to be oscillating at a frequency of about 13 years, at least up till roughly 1990, 1998.
Right, and that's where I want to pick up, that it seems like we're starting, if I'm reading it right, to break that 13-year cycle.
Right. The Lake Michigan Huron dropped at the fastest rate ever observed, and there's a very long record there. Beginning about that time, and it reached its lowest level ever recorded in about 2013, and our lakes were doing the same thing. And quite frankly, we don't know why that's happened. Something has changed in this signal that's been driven by precipitation and evaporation. And data from some of our other colleagues suggests that the evaporation signal may be coming much stronger.
Is that 13-year cycle a pattern of climate, and is it possible that climate change is disrupting that 13-year cycle?
Well, it's definitely climatic. There's an atmospheric phenomenon that starts in the central North Pacific near Japan. And it generates a wave train that moves across the Pacific up into North America, across our area, and then out into the North Atlantic. It's similar to the jet stream, but it's located in a different place in the atmosphere. And that's what determines the storm tracks around our region and across North America. And when that's set up the right way, our water levels rise. And they rise because the moisture from the Gulf of Mexico is swept into our region, and we see more precipitation and less evaporation. Now, when it's not set up that way, our lakes fall because we're getting more evaporation and less precipitation. What we have are correlations between that and our lake levels, so it would suggest that something's changed in that that atmospheric process.
And is that change what we would point to and say, this is global warming, this is climate change?
That's a big step. Mm-hmm. We don't really know whether things have changed for the long run or whether this is just kind of a hiccup in what's happened in the past. And really, only time's going to be able to answer that question.
One thing that I've seen people blame is not that cycle of precipitation and evaporation, but human activity, widening channels leading out of the Great Lakes into the St. Lawrence Seaway, letting too much water out of the Great Lakes. You don't see that as a main factor?
Well, since our little lakes are behaving the same way as that huge lake and our groundwaters are doing the same thing, it seems unlikely that that's the cause for the recent very low water levels. It may be a contributing factor, but the big factor is something else. It's something related to climate.
We're in the midst of a very cold winter, high ice levels, much higher than we've seen in a while. How does that affect the water levels in the lakes?
Well, they bounced back. They bounced back last summer, but they haven't bounced back to where they normally are. They're still well below their long-term averages and way below their long-term peaks. So it's helping, and we expect these sorts of things to occur over time. We'll see things rebounding and then dropping again and rebounding. And the question really is, are we ever going to get back to our old cycle? And as I mentioned, our crystal ball doesn't let us look that far ahead.
What are the implications if we don't bounce back to that level for the environment and maybe for the economy?
Well, lakes are certainly a big part of the economy up north, and we are in a very water-rich region. We depend heavily on our water. Less of it is probably not a good thing. There was an interesting study that came out just before ours by researchers at the Center for Limnology that demonstrated how these low water levels affect fish populations. If you look at photographs of these northern lakes, you see that the coarse woody habitat, the fallen trees that are in the near shore and serve as critical habitat for fish, were exposed. So that habitat was eliminated, and that study demonstrated that the fisheries can be greatly impacted by these water level fluctuations, in particular low water levels.
Well, it's the nature of research often that one answer generates a dozen questions. What questions are you excited to research next? What research do you think needs to be done now?
Well, I think this study focused a lot of attention on evaporation. We're really good at measuring precipitation, and we've been doing it for a long, long time. But we're just beginning to develop the tools to measure evaporation. It's particularly difficult to measure evaporation from a huge lake like Lake Michigan Huron or Lake Superior. Our smaller lakes are a bit easier, so we're hoping to develop tools on these smaller lakes that will help us understand what's going on with the bigger lakes as well.
Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Carl Watrous. He's a research scientist with the Wisconsin DNR. It's time to talk Congress now.
Congress is actually off this week for its mid-January break, which has some people wondering, should representatives spend more time getting work done in Washington, or do the breaks allow them to stay grounded in local politics back home?
Also, with President Obama's State of the Union speech coming up next Tuesday, is he going to be able to set the agenda for Congress? Where do proposals on NSA reforms, immigration, and income inequality stand in Congress?
Here with us for our weekly update is Paul Singer. He's the politics and Congress editor at USA Today, and he tweets at Singer News. Paul, great to have you back.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Congress recently returned from a break, as I understand it, at the beginning of January. They're on break again now. And some observers and politicians think, you know, they're gone an awful lot when there's so much work to be done. So why is there? Can you make the case for all the downtime that's built into the schedule?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the obvious reason for the downtime built in the schedule is they say it's not downtime. It is time spent back in the district, working with their constituents on issues, getting to, you know, hear from constituents about things that matter to them. They would make the argument, well, you want us here on the ground in you know, Madison, Wisconsin, because you want us to be able to hear from you more regularly and you want more access to us. Of course, there really is this tension in American politics, right? On the one hand, we don't want our politicians to become career politicians, people who are beholden to Washington, who spend all their time in Washington. We love to elect outsiders. On the other hand, when they don't go to Washington, we complain that they're goofing off. You know, and so then we argue, well, why aren't you in Washington solving the nation's problems? It is a bit of a double-edged sword. I'm not sure there's a real way for them to win that issue. But they do have, you know, written into their schedules now, at least a week a month is recess. But they'll say it's district work period, not recess.
So that's the branding there, and maybe that's exactly what they're doing. There are, the Christian Science Monitor, they had a piece about people who want some reform and about how some of these people look back at what they call the good old days when the representatives, they lived in Washington, they went to all the kids' soccer games together, the same barbecues. And in short, I guess they kind of knew each other. It wasn't fly in, fly out anymore. And you can imagine that the schedule right now with all the recesses could be tough when you're trying to get to a place of bipartisanship.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, some of that is rose-colored glasses. You know, I mean, the members of Congress who are here, they still are pals. They still get together and, you know, share a beer and stuff. There's a really, particularly for newer members of Congress and particularly for the Republicans, it's a really interesting tension. Because a lot of them, again, they came as outsiders or as Tea Party supported candidates. They don't want to become wedded to Washington, so they choose not to even have a home here in D.C. They sleep in their congressional offices on Capitol Hill.
Really?
Yeah. There's several dozen of them that sleep on cots in their offices, and they leave their family back in the district. Well, I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing either, right? Because then you're away from your family. You're not doing anything at 11 o'clock on a Wednesday night except sleeping on a cot in your office. If someone calls you up and says, hey, let's go to the bar and get a beer, you're likely to go and irresponsible bad things happen. So it's a tension that the members, particularly incoming members now, have to grapple with. Is do you want to leave your roots really planted in wherever it was you came from? Or do you want to have your family with you and you know, set up some stake in Washington, D.C.?
So it sounds like there's arguments on both sides. Do you see the situation with recesses changing anytime soon, or is this just the way it is now?
Nah, it is the way it is. I mean, this is very much the way it is. I think it's institutionalized. In fact, in the House calendar, they've already put out the whole year's schedule of when we'll be off. So it's very much in the bloodstream here.
And is there evidence that when there are recesses, that Congress is in fact back home, getting in touch with the people in their district?
Well, sure. But there's also evidence that frequently when there are recesses, they are back home making touch with their good friends in Switzerland or Hawaii or some other fun place to go on a congressional delegation. I mean, right now, there's a congressional delegation gone to Davos, Switzerland for the World Economic Forum. You could, again, make the argument that it's important for members of Congress to go hobnob with the sort of intellectual elite on economic affairs, or you could make the argument that taxpayers have just spent several $100,000 sending 10 members of Congress over to a highfalutin Swiss resort to basically party.
You know, we have a call. We don't normally take calls during this segment, but let's take this one. We've got Jill joining us from Janesville. Hi, Jill. Jill,
hi,
are you with us?
I just wanted to, hi. I wanted to comment right away when I heard that there was a feeling that maybe these people weren't working when they're home. My personal experience has been serving on Congressman Ryan's healthcare advisory board, and he goes right from one board meeting after then to ours and then heads to another one. So I can say from my personal experience that I see our congressman work very hard when he's not in D.C., and I believe that he does keep his roots at home so that he can be connected and stay connected.
All right. Well, that's great. It's great to hear from you and to hear that story about Wisconsin. And Paul, that sounds like something that a lot of, I imagine, representatives in Congress would say they do the same. They're working hard.
Yeah.
They're going home and they're keeping in touch.
And it's very true that, you know, the members were basically ordered in the previous Congress, go back to your district and do these, what they call Congress in your corner, Congress on your corner, I think they called it. You know, go have public events in the district. Let them get to know you. Of course, a lot of those, they also do a lot of fundraising events. There's a book, I will tell you, I teach journalism as well, and there's a book I frequently assign then Congressman Sherrod Brown from Ohio wrote a book about called Congress from the Inside. And he has in there some of his schedule. He's now a senator from Ohio. But he has in there some of his schedule of the weekends he goes home. You know, he's doing a parade on the 4th of July and then the Rotary breakfast and then he's meeting with constituents. And it's exhausting. Some members will tell you they get more rest and relaxation here on work weeks than they do back in the district.
Oh. Well, that's interesting. And it's not something that's going to be changed anytime soon, it sounds like.
So I don't think so.
Let's move on to some actual prospective legislation. There was a report out this morning in the New York Times describing some bipartisanship on immigration between Democrat Esther Olivaria and Republican Rebecca Talent, and some people saying that these two are going to put their heads together and they could be the glue that held immigration reform together. What do you make of that?
Well, sure. I mean, neither one of them is actually a member of Congress. Ms. Talent now is a staffer working for Mr. Boehner, and Ms. Olivaria is working for the White House on these issues. You know, these are the people who will be sort of, you know, working the deal or working to get the deal at some point if they can get that far. But, you know, don't get your hopes up. The first thing that's going to happen is we're waiting for Mr. Boehner to release a basically a set of principles on what should be in an immigration bill coming out of the House. And so here it is, the last week of January, we'll get a set of principles. That's not legislation, that's principles.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Is that unusual, issuing a set of principles in the lead-up to a vote?
Well, I don't know about unusual. I mean, it's not all that unusual for, you know, the party leaders to do stuff like that, say, here are the kind of things we want to get into legislation. I think what's unusual about it is that the Senate already has passed a bill. The House has four or five bills that have passed out of committee already. It seems odd to go back to the principles stage when you're this far down a legislative road. And it raises questions about, well, okay, if you're just issuing principles now, what's that mean for actually developing a bill? And again, in the House, they're less interested in developing a comprehensive bill. They're more interested in doing several pieces of legislation independently that they think are more palatable.
And next Tuesday, another thing on the horizon is President Obama's State of the Union address. How likely is it that he has enough political capital left to set the agenda for Congress?
Well, he definitely has the ability to set the conversation, right? I mean, there is nothing like a State of the Union address to focus the national conversation around key topics. And we think that Obama is going to want to focus the national conversation around, for want of a better word, income inequality issues like raising the minimum wage, like reinstating unemployment insurance for the long-term unemployed. Those are the kind of issues where he can really focus a bright light in that moment, right? Having the podium and having a big national audience. Now, I'm not sure that means he can actually wrangle a bill through Congress, but he can definitely set the tone for the national discussion. And I think that those are the things you're going to hear quickly then followed up by Democrats in Congress trying to move the unemployment bill that got stuck before they left to try and possibly move something on minimum wage, possibly some other things to, you know, more flexible hours for working mothers kind of things. Things that address that topic, whether or not they pass or not, is a bigger issue. But I think the president certainly has the opportunity to drive the conversation here.
And he did bring a lot of attention to NSA reforms last Friday. Is that something that could be moving through Congress?
Yeah, that will definitely be on the agenda next week. In fact, I believe it's Wednesday, the Judiciary Committee will be hearing from Attorney General Eric Holder. I think he's coming up for a hearing on the Justice Department. And I have no doubt this will be a central theme of that conversation, is the NSA reforms, because they do have, you know, now they have some actual reforms recommended by the president, and they're going to have to start moving on trying to implement some of these things, or at least discuss whether they can implement them. Now, keep in mind, we may not hear details about a lot of this stuff because it may be classified. But I think some portions of it, you know, if they can figure out a way to, you know, get the government out of the business of collecting giant databases on all our telephone calls, we'll probably hear about that.
All right, Paul, thank you so much for joining us and keeping us up to date.
Always a pleasure, Veronica. Talk to you again.
We've been speaking with Paul Singer for our weekly Washington Update. He is the politics and Congress editor at USA Today and tweets at Singer News.
Our next guest says that despite having relied on religion for centuries, humanity is losing its faith and the world is becoming increasingly secular. He says that's a problem for many people, and as a result, they're left longing for something more and something deeper.
His remedy to that? Creating your own personalized religion that works for you and that can include borrowing ideas and practices from formal religions and finding the spiritual connections in music and literature and art.
Our guest is Thomas Moore. He's a psychotherapist, a former monk, and his latest book is A Religion of One's Own, a guide to creating a personal spirituality in a secular world. Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, this idea of putting together our own religion, our own spiritual system, it sounds kind of radical, maybe even sacrilegious to some people. Can you talk about what first set you down this road and how people have reacted so far?
I've been thinking about this for a long time. It was at the end of his life that Thomas Merton, the Catholic monk, said that it's time to stop relying on the structures around us and go on it on our own and create our own spiritual way. And so it's been around a while, this idea. I see a lot of people, talk to a lot of people who are either kind of succumbing to the secular explanations for life today, a lot of brain studies and scientific studies that are wonderful in themselves, but don't deal with the spiritual very well. And so it seems to me that people can find a way without going back to traditions and formal practices that they don't want anymore. There are ways of being religious today that just take a little imagination.
You spent 12 years as a monk, but you say that in this point of your life, 40 years or so later, you feel more religious now than ever. Why is that?
Yes, I feel more Catholic than when I was a monk. Yes, I do. I have been exploring religion all these years. I eventually got a PhD in the study of religion. And so as part of that, I studied many different religious traditions. And the study of them had a big impact on me. Sometimes I call myself a Zen Catholic these days, although I probably don't fit into either category terribly well. But I have learned a lot from all these religious traditions, and I think that we can have a different approach to them today. I think in the past we thought you had to be a member, so you had to choose which religion will I belong to. I think today what we can do is say that these traditions have a lot to offer us. Each of them has a lot to offer us, and we don't have to sample them superficially. We can actually really get into them and see what they have to offer. And over time, we can develop from all of that experience, develop our own approach to being religious.
It sounds like a lot of work in some ways. So if someone wants to explore this idea and say, yes, I want to establish my own personal religion or religion of my own, how do I start?
Well, you know, first of all, your point that it's a lot of work. People are already doing quite a bit of work, and they're doing it with a considerable anxiety. I mean, this idea of searching, you know, being a seeker is not always so pleasant. It's kind of painful for a lot of people. So, but I think that the way you do it, you can start by exploring some of the great religious art or the religious texts that are around and so easy to get to today. The one, for example, one that I often recommend people do looking at is the Tao Te Ching, or the Tao Te Ching from China. It's very short. It's less than 100 pages. And you can read it thoughtfully and meditatively. I do it several times a year. And it gives you a point of view on life, how to be, that you won't find anywhere else. And then you can look at other sources. You can read some wonderful Sufi poetry. A lot of people like Rumi today. And if you do that seriously, not just dip into it, but really, really take some time with it, then these various experiences will leave a mark on you. You don't have to be, you know, get a PhD like I did. You get a good sampling of the various religious traditions, and you'd be surprised how quickly you change and shift and how much you learn.
It seems like a big urge driving your work is the idea that we shouldn't separate out daily life over here and religion in that church building or temple over there, and trying to incorporate our personal religion, whatever form it takes, into our daily lives and our daily awareness. How important is that?
Well, yes, that's really at the heart of it. I learned that when I was a monk all those many years ago. I was taught in those days that the work I did, whether it was outside pruning trees, by the way, I was in Wisconsin doing that. I was pruning trees and cleaning up the building or cleaning bathrooms, even all that kind of thing. I was taught that was my religious work, that was part of my religion to do that. And, you know, to work is to pray, they would say. And, you know, that really made a lot of sense to me because it helped me put together my everyday life with my religious life, and it taught me that everything, when you look at it deeply enough, everything is sacred. Everything touches on a level that is meaningful, and that ties into the most important values in the world around us. And I think that really is a good base for being religious. You can do that whether you're going to a church, you're involved in a formal religion or not. I think you can have your own religion in either case, but especially for people who are seekers today, I think this is a good approach.
You mentioned to work is to pray. Also, I think I read to walk is to pray. You quote somebody saying that we should walk like an elephant to harness our spirituality or engage with it. How does that work?
That was a Zen master, Shunryu Suzuki. He was a wonderful teacher, and he had some very strong images like that, to walk like an elephant. I think what he meant was that that when you walk, when you do anything really, that you do it deliberately and patiently and not too quickly, and you feel your own weight as you go. I mean, that's a big thing too, I think, about the elephant. You feel your weight so that I think a lot of people, when they approach religion, especially formal religion, they don't have their own weight at all. They feel that this church or organization or the leader, whoever it is, has a lot more to offer, and you have to submit to that. In this religion of your own, you take on the responsibility, but you also take on the pleasure and the joy of finding your own way and finding religious and spiritual practices that suit you as a person, as an individual.
Now, I imagine somebody who's a follower of a particular formal, traditional religious tradition may be thinking, this all sounds a bit squishy. I follow a religion that has divinely inspired precepts, ideas, and I can't pick and choose among them. It's not my choice to make. How would you answer somebody coming from that angle?
Well, I can certainly appreciate that. I was living in that world for a long time. And I don't mean to take that away. I think if that's how you feel, that's really wonderful. If you have that certainty and if you have that backing, that's fine. But I do think that for too long we have surrendered ourselves, that we haven't really put ourselves into the equation. I'm always quoting Emerson, who said that every church has a membership of one. You know, that even though you have all these people that are members of these churches, and in the end, it's really the individual has to do it and decide what to believe, what not to believe, and how to practice and how not to practice. So what I'm doing here is not really challenging any of those beliefs or the authorities or the revelations, whatever they are. Not at all. I really respect those. But I do think that it's time to stop being so passive about it. And as a matter of fact, I'm a psychotherapist, and I've written about sadomasochism in the past, and I think there's a way in which, in religion, people tend to be masochistic. That is, they give themselves up too readily and too easily, and they don't feel that weight of themselves. They don't feel that they are the creator of their own religion.
At the opposite end of the spectrum, suppose an atheist is listening or reading your book saying, wait, does having my own religion, even if I'm defining it, does that mean I have to embrace something supernatural, something that I don't believe in by an atheistic nature?
You know, what I'm talking about is not really belief. It's not. That's an old way of thinking, I think, about religion, where we think, what do you believe, what do I believe, and compare them and see which is best. That's not really, I think, the heart of it. The heart of it is not belief so much as how you are in the world and how you see the world you live in, how your everyday life goes. Can you really perceive, let's say, an obvious thing, the sacredness in nature? Can you really, you know, is that part of your life? The natural world can be a really essential part of a person's spiritual life. Or what about the arts? The arts, too, in our secular world don't really have much place. But in tradition, they were very closely associated with religion, and I think we can return to that. So maybe meditating, listening to music, developing a taste for music and for the visual arts, that also can be woven into your spiritual practice. And so then the religion is not so much about belief. You can have your beliefs, whatever they are, if they're important to you. It's more about the practice and who you are as a human being as a result of your point of view.
We're talking with Thomas More. His new book is A Religion of One's Own. It's about how to create a set of spiritual beliefs that works for you, engages you with your spirituality on a daily basis. What do you think about this idea? Have you tried bringing spirituality into your daily life in some way? Do you like this idea of picking and choosing from different traditions and philosophies, art, and music, as we'll get into in a minute? Give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@wpr.org. We're talking with Thomas More about finding our own sets of spiritual beliefs, building a religion of one's own. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about his idea? If you're someone who follows an organized religion, what do you make of it? Or if you don't, does this idea of putting together your own spiritual beliefs, maybe inspired by the religions of the world, does this appeal to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get your calls in just a moment. But first, Thomas, you touched on this briefly, reaching outside of religious and spiritual traditions and being inspired by art as well as music and literature. Why is that important?
Well, I guess the one way to get at that is to tell you that when I was studying religion, doing my doctoral studies, we had a division of that study called Religion and Literature. That was really important to me because we got rid of that line that separates secular from sacred literature. So I was very interested in reading certain playwrights, like Samuel Beckett was really important for me then, Emily Dickinson. People who were poets who would not be associated with a particular religion, but whose poetry and literature writings, plays, raised questions of meaning and belief and faith and trust and the very core of your life and where you find inspiration and direction. So we didn't make that distinction so much between sacred and secular. So what I'm suggesting here for anyone else is that trying to offer all different resources that you can have as you develop your own spiritual life, making up your own religion, that you can also turn to the so-called secular arts, but look at them with this intention, with this different point of view, that this is not entertainment, that these arts and these artists are really trying to probe what human life is all about at such a level that they have equal weight, or at least they have something serious to offer to the search for a spiritual meaning in your own life.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Roxanne with us in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Roxanne, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask you if you have looked into Ekankar. It has helped me immensely develop my own religion. Ekankar is something very serious to me. I'll spell it. It's Ekankar. And it began ancient Eastern religion, and it's, like I said, it's just been a spiritually very important to me. I thought I'd just pass it on.
All right. Thanks for the call, Roxanne.
Roxanne, thank you. I know a lot of people, many, many people, who have turned to Eastern sources, you know, to find an alternative. Especially, I think the East is valuable because the point of view is very rich and deep, and it's different from what goes on in the West, where we tend to emphasize sort of an intellectual belief. And in the East, it's more of a question of being, you know, of who you are, and being changed by the things that you study and the practices that you have. My family, for example, my wife and daughter are Sikhs. That is, they practice Kundalini Yoga very seriously, and it's a very important part of their religious way. It's not mine at all, so we're very different that way. But I think that that the Ekankar is an example of of finding something that appeals to you, and I think it's a very individual thing. Somebody else may not be moved so much by it, but you can spread the word, and people can say, "Well, I want to give that a try."
Roxanne, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Peter in Cedarburg. Peter, hi.
Oh, hi. I wanted to call in. I agree with your speaker. It's not so much your belief, you know, that you get bogged down with, but what kind of daily spiritual practice you have that really changes you as a human being in the present moment. And I'd also like to add, I mean, books like the last caller Eckhart, I really enjoy quite a bit and found a lot of insight and inspiration. But I think one also needs to find a teacher sometimes if you want to explore a certain path. You know, they're not going to knock on your door and say, gee whiz, would you like to be my student? So, you know, folks have to put some effort into, you know, a spiritual practice that they're interested in learning more about and take it from there, I think.
Peter, thanks for the call. And Thomas, what do you think of that idea of seeking out a mentor or a teacher?
Well, yes, I think that helps a great deal. It's one of the old, very ancient ways of developing your spiritual life, to have a teacher. I wouldn't want to literalize it too much. You know, in all the things I'm suggesting in this book, I'm suggesting that you take some of these old ways, but you make them your own and bring them up to date. And I know for me, I began reading the psychology of Carl Jung when I was probably in my mid-30s, maybe a little before then. And he became a mentor for me, even though I never met him. You know, his work and especially his writing about his own spiritual path, which was very rich and very informed, and came from all over the world, from traditions all over the world. And he was very active in taking these traditions and making them his own and going deeply into them. And that affected me a great deal. So what I'm saying is that sometimes your teacher may not be somebody that you go and physically link up with, but you may discover through their writing or in other ways that that they appeal to you and can take you to that deep place.
Peter, thanks for the call. We've got Rich in Sauk County with us now. Rich, hi, you're on the air.
Yes. I would like to just relay a little story that you know, I was Catholic for 60 some odd years of 67 years total, and our youngest son is gay, and we struggle with that in our Catholic religion and the fact that he was gay and the Catholic religion, their opinion of gay people. And about 5, 6, 7 years ago, we just cut the ties, period. We wrote a letter to our pastor and said, you know, we can't handle this anymore. And then I started to read, and I had a book from Richard Dawkins, who was an avowed atheist, and several other books of Evolution of God, and et cetera, et cetera. Some of them were pretty heavy lifts, just to try to get a handle on it. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I tell people is I'm not an atheist. I'm not an agnostic. What bothers me about people's concept of God, or what puts a kink in it for me, is the mainstream religions that they turn me off in. And some of them are good, and they do a lot of good things, but it's a lot of hypocrisy.
All right, Rich, thanks a lot for sharing your story. And Thomas, that sounds like the clash between making your life conform to your formal religion, or wrapping your religion around the reality of your life a little bit.
Yes, I think so. You know, one of the issues, there's so much we could talk about there, and so many people would have a similar story. But one of the issues is that a lot of people, have an understanding of their religion that is directly from their childhood. You know, we don't teach religion at a high level very much. I mean, equal to other fields. You know, our studies of science and math go shoot up into college, but it's very difficult to get a good education in the spiritual realm. And so a lot of people are rather, you know, in a child fantasy or a kind of not exactly having that elephant weight of their adulthood as they go along. And so they run up against the authority and the teachings of a church or a tradition that they just can't buy, and so they leave the tradition. Instead of maybe causing some change or shaping that religion, deciding, I'm not going to leave it if I really want it, but I'm going to have to make some decisions. I can buy 90% of it, but 10% I just can't. And I'm going to go ahead and take what I need from it, but not that 10%. So there are different ways of dealing with it, but I wish that we could be more adult in relationship to it and not follow so in such a weak manner that we often do.
Before we're done, can you briefly tell us, what's the benefit? If we do this, we build a religion of our own, what do we get out of it?
Well, what you get out of it is the very deep satisfaction. This is at the end of my book. I talk about bliss. We get not a superficial happiness or a solving of the problems of life, but you live at a much deeper level. You are in touch with the eternal and timeless matters that are with us no matter what, like having to deal with a serious illness or divorce or our children being in trouble. These are mysterious, profound things that come to us, and they cannot be resolved entirely by psychology and by sociology. They require a vision that's very deep and strong and big. And so I think that developing a religiousness of your own can help you live in a way that's profoundly satisfying.
Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Thomas Moore. His new book is A Religion of One's Own.